Good morning, my beloved brothers and sisters and young people. So we're moving now through the ministry of Elisha, and we're coming really to the end of a 70-year period. It's really the climax of God's effort to draw back Israel from the false worship of Baal and to draw them back to himself, the only true and living God. And really, once these two prophets have passed off the scene, then there is only the slippery slope downwards for Israel and the captivity from the north. And as we come to consider chapter 5 this morning, 2 Kings chapter 5, and the story of Naaman, we're now really seeing the work of Elisha in the calling out of a remnant, the election by grace, the quiet, still voice that is now working away among the people of God and bringing forth men and women to salvation. If we just reflect for a moment on the characters that come before us. When Elijah was hidden by God for 3 years, there was Obadiah and Obadiah's parents, obviously a godly family. They're in the heart of apostasy. And as we turn over the pages and we come to a later chapter there in the first book of Kings, we're introduced to Naboth, aren't we? 1 Kings chapter 21. And it's little insights into these characters that remind us that the still small voice works, that it raises up people who become giants in their own way, that they can actually manifest the name of God in all sorts of actions and words in daily life. Ahab covets Naboth's vineyard. And so he says to him in verse 2, "Give me the vineyard that I may have it for a garden of herbs, because it is near unto my house, and I will give thee for it a better vineyard than it. Or if it seem good to thee, I will give thee its worth in money." Well, it seems a reasonable sort of offer. I mean, not the sort of offer that any normal person would feel upset about, surely. You know, I'll give you a bigger and a better one. Well, that's not bad going. Or I'll even give you a lot of money for it, and then you can go and do what you like with the money. You could buy yourself perhaps two or three other vineyards. So it's a nice, attractive human offer. But what does Naboth say? Verse 3, "The Lord forbid it me that I should give the inheritance of my fathers unto thee." Just one simple little sentence. "No, thank you. God has given me what I've got. It was allocated to us, our family, when we came into the land. We don't want to make it any bigger. We don't want to make it any smaller. We're quite happy with what we've got. And I am not going to disobey the law of God." Because he's really reminding Ahab, isn't he, of Leviticus chapter 25 and Numbers chapter 36. You look in your margins, and that's where the Levitical law of inheritance was set down by God. You know, even if you lost it because you came in debt, at a certain point in the calendar it went back to you, didn't it? People were not going to make gain out of other people's misfortune in God's kingdom. In God's kingdom all are equal and all are given that which God requires them to have. And learning to be content with what God gives us, and then to see it as a blessing from God and not something to be treated lightly and disposed of and used to fulfill a whim or a fancy or to satisfy a desire or an emotion. God gives us responsibilities in life. He gives us the talent and he says, "There you are. That's what I've given you. Now use what I've given you. But do it the way that I have told you to do it." So Naboth refuses, and we know the outcome, don't we? Like some sport child, Ahab goes home, he sulks, he doesn't eat, he kicks up a fuss, and ultimately his wife notices that all's not well, and she says, "What's the matter with you?" Wives are like that, they're very perceptive, aren't they? They always know when something's upset the husband. And so she fixes it for him. She gets the false men to tell lies. He gets stoned. He's dead. There you are. You can have it. And like some spoilt child, he gallops off to get his prize. Only, of course, when he gets there, he finds the prophet Elijah sitting waiting for him. And it didn't turn out to be quite as joyful as he thought, did it? But there in verse 17, the word of the Lord came to Elijah the Tishbite, saying, "Arise, go down to meet Ahab, king of Israel, which is in Samaria. Behold, he is in the vineyard of Naboth, whither he has gone down to possess it. And thou shalt speak unto him, saying, Thus saith the Lord, hast thou killed and also taken possession? And thou shalt speak unto him, saying, Thus saith the Lord, in the place where the dogs lick the blood of Naboth, shall the dogs lick thy blood, even thine." And so Elijah goes to this man who's now standing there looking at all he's got around him, this beautiful vineyard, the thing that he's coveted most of all. Here it is, it's his now. Naboth's gone, and he doesn't have to ask too many questions about how he went or why he went or who did it. All that matters is he's got what he wanted. And Ahab says to Elijah, "Hast thou found me, O mine enemy?" As though Elijah would have any trouble finding him. When God wants to find us, he finds us, brothers and sisters. "I have found thee because thou hast sold thyself to work evil in the sight of Yahweh." That's the story of Ahab. He sold himself for a vineyard. But Naboth, you see, comes across to us as a righteous man, as a man who knew what God wanted from him, knew how he was to live his life, knew what God expected him to do, and was content to do it. It's a sad story, isn't it? Poor Naboth, stoned to death for doing the right thing, and another man takes possession of his vineyard. But you see, Naboth will have more vineyards than he knows what to do with, won't he, in the kingdom? Naboth will be granted everlasting life. Naboth is a man who stood by the principles that God set before him, and he wasn't prepared to give up anywhere. You just turn over into the second book of Kings, chapter 4. We read it yesterday, didn't we, at the beginning there. We looked at the widow and we looked at the Shunammite. But verse 42 introduces us to an anonymous man. "And there came a man from Baal Shalisha and brought the man of God bread of the first fruits, 20 loaves of barley and full ears of corn in the husker of." This man came from a place called Baal Shalisha. Well, if you go back to 1 Samuel, you'll find there that it used to be called Shalisha. But in this time of apostasy under Ahab and Jezebel, it has now become Baal Shalisha, because it has become a place where the false god is worshipped. And there is a drought and a famine and a time of dearth. And this man turns up and he comes to Elisha. And he brings before Elisha the offering. What he's brought is that which is recorded in Deuteronomy chapter 6. He's brought the first fruits of his harvest. And what did the man do with it? What did Elisha do with it? He said, "Give unto the people that they may eat." And his servant said, "What shall I set this before 100 men?" He said again, "Give the people that they may eat, for thus saith the Lord, they shall eat and shall leave thereof." So he set it before them, and they did eat and left thereof according to the word of the Lord. Here's the precursor to the Lord feeding the multitudes during his ministry. Here's a man who lived in an apostate and corrupt society in a town that was named after the false god. And because he could find no one in that town, there was no priest, there was no prophet, he comes out of his town and he brings the first fruits of his offering at a time when there is a famine, when he could do with all the food that he had. His family would want everything that they could get out of the ground. He took the first fruits of his offering, and in spite of all the difficulties of life, he came and he offered it to the Lord. And the Lord took it, and the Lord multiplied it. And that which was a little became a lot because of the faithfulness of this man. And so Again, we see that here was a man who knew what God wanted him to do. And the difficulties of life do not change the principles of life, brothers and sisters, do they? It doesn't matter how the circumstances and the environment changes, the principles of God hold firm. Now, perhaps if he said, well, I won't take all that I should. You know, well, it's a bad time, isn't it? You know, there's a famine on, and there's not a lot of food about. I'll just hold on to it this time. Next time I'll take double. You know, when it's all over, I'll give a lot more to God. But he didn't do that. You see, what he brought here, when you go back to the book of Deuteronomy, this first fruit offering, it was the time of the Passover. He was remembering that this was an act of remembrance, that God had delivered them, that God had brought them forth out of bondage, that when there was no eye to see or arm to save, it was the Lord who had brought deliverance. So it didn't matter how difficult. It didn't matter that the neighbours might think he was stupid. It didn't matter that he might upset the prophets of Baal. It didn't matter what anybody else thought. All this man was worried about was doing the right thing in the sight of God. And he did it. And because of his faithfulness, others were blessed. It fed 100. And the servant of Elijah said, what do you mean set this out before these 100 people? This isn't going to do any good. I wonder if Elisha had got the 100 people together in readiness for the man coming. You see, a simple act of faith on the part of one person is like a stone dropping in a pond. The ripples just spread out and keep going. And that's what our lives are like, brothers and sisters. This is an apostate, a degenerate world. This is a world that's full of false gods every way we turn. And to act on principle, to act in faith, will mark us out as very strange and different people. But it's that simple act of faith that is the witness that there is a God, the God of Israel, whom we believe and put our trust in. Now when we just move on into chapter 5, we come to the next little character, don't we? And she's a wonderful little character. She's been taken away from her home, and she's been taken into a foreign land, and she's become a servant. And we're not told her name, but she works as a servant in the house of this great soldier. And the man, for all his greatness, for all the ceremony, for all the status that he carried in society, he had a problem. He was a leper. And what did this little girl say? Well, verse 3, she said unto her mistress, would God my Lord were with the prophet that is in Samaria, for he would recover him of his leprosy, out of the mouth of babes and sucklings. Here is this little maid who is a servant to the mistress of Naaman. And she says, well, you know, if Naaman was in Israel, Elisha could cure him of his leprosy. What faith, brethren and sisters. Why should she believe in the God of Israel? She's just been carried away from her family, from her home, from her, all the things that she counted dear, from the ability to be able to worship the God that she had grown up to know and to love. And there she is in a foreign country, in an alien environment, surrounded by people who worship false gods. And yet this young woman is able to say, if only you were back in Israel, the prophet Elisha, he'd solve all your problems. He'd take away that leprosy from you. And she must have had something about her, you know, because the woman she spoke to made sure that Naaman found out about it. You know, there must have been a lot of chit-chat that goes on in a big household. What was it about this little woman's demeanour? The way she conducted herself? I mean, you see, it's no good suddenly saying something that's important when all the rest of the time you've been saying a lot of trivia. There's no point in trying to act seriously when you've only been acting flippantly, because nobody's going to take you seriously. It's quite obvious that when this little girl said this, the woman listened to her. Because when she spoke in a way that brought respect. She wasn't someone who was just flippant and couldn't care less. She didn't bemoan her luck and begrudge her misfortune. Here was someone who made an impact by the witness of her faith. And so the message goes from Naaman's household to the king, and the king says, fine, we'll get enough money together, we've got plenty of money, it's not a problem. Everything's solved with money, isn't it? Money solves all problems. So, you take 10 talents of silver, 6,000 shekels of gold, 10 changes of raiment, here's a letter saying, put this right, and I can afford to pay whatever the price is, and off you go. Throw money, throw enough money at a problem, and it'll go away. That's the way of the world, isn't it? Doesn't change at all. It's exactly what all would, if only we had more money, we'd solve all the problems. That's all we want. Everybody's got a bowl out looking for money. It's always the answer to every problem. Throw money at it. So, right now we know where the answer lies. It lies there. We just send enough money and we'll have the problem solved. And so he sent a letter. And Naaman arrives with the king of Israel. Well, we obviously at this time we're at a period of peace. I mean, they've come down on marauding bands and they've taken people away as slaves and servants, but this is obviously a time of a sort of settled peace for a little while between Israel and Syria. And so the king of Israel gets the letter. What a statement, brothers. Just look at that statement he makes. He reads the letter, he rends his clothes, he says, am I God to kill and to make alive? Well, there was a God who killed and made alive, wasn't there? There was a prophet who could do that very thing in his own country. And by this statement, the absence of faith and understanding of this king is brought before us. He says, all he's trying to do is make a quarrel. He knows I can't do anything about this. Who ever heard of anybody being cured of leprosy? You know, and I don't care how much money he's spent, that's not going to solve the problem. And all he's doing is going to find an excuse to start another war. Well, by the power of the Spirit, obviously, Elisha gets to know about this. And Elisha says, why are you getting upset? What's the problem with you? You know, I'm here. All you had to do was pick up the phone and ask. All you had to do was just let me know. All you had to do was say, go see Elisha. Because that's what the little girl had said, hadn't she? Would God my Lord were with the prophet that is in Samaria. She knew where he was, and she knew where he had to go. So the little maid knew, and the man sitting on the throne at the top, he didn't have a clue what to do. What a difference. What a contrast. In that society, you see the still small voice. It's now among the people, moving backwards and forwards. And that layer up there, well, they're eating, drinking and making merry and playing at being kings, and they haven't got a clue what's going on. Not a clue. And so he sent to the door of Elisha. And here's the first lesson, brothers and sisters. Here's the first lesson, isn't it? This man has to be humbled. So the prophet doesn't even come out the door to see him. He just sends a message out. Go wash in the Jordan 7 times. And you can picture the scene, can't you? There they all lined up. 1 chariot, 2 chariots, 3 chariots, 4 chariots. There are all the servants milling around. There he is. He's got his colonel-in-chief uniform on and all his medals for the wars that he's fought. And there's the booty all lined up. Sacks of money, chests of shekels. And there they all are, and they're all outside the house, and Elisha doesn't even bother to open the door. And he sends a message. Just go wash 7 times in the Jordan, you'll be fine. And you can see it, can't you? You can see, they say, he sent a message. Well, who's going to tell him? Will you tell him? Okay, I'll tell him. And you can see that he's standing there, and normally everyone's coming up and saluting, and they're all bowing, and this prophet doesn't even show his face. Just go and do it. And he flies into a rage, and when a colonel flies into a rage, then everybody's got problems. You know, this man is in charge of the army, and we're told right at the very beginning he was a great man, and I mean, you don't upset great men. He was angry, it says in verse 11. And he turns around and bright, and he's into his chariot. He said, well, I thought at least the fella could do was come out and sort of strike the spot and call on the name of Yahweh, God of Israel. At least he could have done that. He hasn't even bothered to come out. But again, you see, down at this lower level, common sense prevails. You see, sometimes we get carried away with our own importance, and we get too big for our boots, and we think that we're the people and it has to be done our way, and we're the only people that know the right way to do something. And quietly the servants talk amongst themselves. Now, these men are quite amazing, really. It says to you in verse 12, he turned and went away in a rage. You can imagine it, can't you? The whip coming up, and the crack of the whip, and the horses rearing, and the chariots roaring off, and everyone's now thinking, oh, this is going to be some day now. What are we in for now? You know, Naaman is in one of his moods, and this is it. But you see, these people, they think, well, we've come a long way. You know, we've actually come quite a long way. And perhaps one of these servants has been talking to the little girl. Who knows what went on in Naaman's household? You see, and they're not going to give up that easily. And so his servants came near and spake unto him. I always laugh because it's the plural here, isn't it? You know, you tell him. No, you have a word with him. No. We'll all go together then, you know. So, you know, finally the chariot sort of slow down a bit and the whole pace, and people begin to calm down, and so the servants say, well, let's just stop the horses a minute and perhaps we could have a word about this. And then they reason with him. My father, if the prophet had bid thee do some great thing, wouldest thou not have done it? How much rather then when he saith to thee, wash and be clean? And you can see the man thinking, oh, I've got nothing to lose, have I? And I suppose it's true. The man said, wash and be clean. And if I go and do this, he's told me, my flesh will come to me again. And so the thought process starts. The man has gone through the humiliation of being treated like an ordinary person. And he's had to learn to get his feelings and his thoughts and his emotions under control. And now he's got to think about what it is that this God has told him to do. Wash and be clean. So he goes off to the Jordan. We're told he went down and dipped himself 7 times in Jordan, according to the saying of the man of God. And his flesh came again, like unto the flesh of a little child, and he was clean. Here's the leper, suddenly cleansed. It's a wonderful picture, isn't it? Because it's the picture that we have in the New Testament, isn't it? You see what this leper does when he's cleansed. He returns immediately to the one who made that cleansing possible, to give thanks to him. Just like the leper does in the New Testament, who comes back to Jesus, and Jesus says, where are all the others? And he says, well, I don't know where all the others are. But the one came back because he had learned that it was the hand of God working in his life. And the consequence of this man going under the water 7 times. And just think about it. This man has to strip off his tunic and all his regalia. And there he is, his servants all lined up at the bank. There's this man who's used to saying go and they go, come and they come. Chop off his head and they chop off his head. Here he is now on the banks of this grotty little river compared with all the fast flowing rivers that he's used to. And he's got to strip down and walk down into the water once. Twice, 3 times, 4 times, 5 times, 6 times, 7 times, and when he comes out, it's actually happened. Now he had to do exactly what God said. See, that's what faith is about, brothers and sisters. It doesn't matter how silly it may seem, it doesn't matter how ridiculous it may seem, it doesn't matter how other people may think this is a total waste of time. What's the good of being baptized? What does baptism do for you? What on earth can going down under the water and coming up out of the water do for you. He that believeth and is baptized shall be saved. If you don't believe, well, you're not going to be baptized. And if you do believe, you've got to be baptized. And only when you believe and being baptized can you be saved. Only when you believe and being baptized can you be reborn and your flesh become again as like a little child. You have to believe, and you have to follow out the actions that God requires of you from that belief. And you have to do it all. It isn't any good just believing and not bothering with baptism. It isn't any good being baptized if you don't believe the right things. It has to be a clear statement. And before you can be reborn, you have to be humble. You have to become like a little child, like a little servant girl who said, oh, that the Naaman were in Israel and the prophet would cure him. You have to have faith like a little child before you can be reborn. You've got to be humble. No matter what your status, no matter how great your authority, no matter what your intelligence, your academic ability, your physical prowess, none of this is going to count for anything. Because, you see, we are all sinners. Right, I don't know if you can all see that very effectively at the back, but leprosy has certain characteristics. It's unique to man. It has imperceptible beginnings. Just a little dot, just a little spot. But it can be very contagious. It's also very deforming. It's progressive. It gradually works itself around the body. Humanly speaking, it's incurable. There is no human cure for it, as far as the scriptures are concerned. And ultimately, it ends in death. You become an outcast, and you die. Now, in Israel, it wasn't a physician that did the cleaning, the cleansing, but a priest. And any cure was considered a miracle. And the leper was outside the camp, cut off from God. Now, when we put the comparison there out of sin, we can see how, in fact, leprosy is a very apt symbol for sin. Because by one man, sin entered the world, and so sin passed upon all. It is deceitful, sin. It creeps up on you. It starts in a very small way, and gradually it takes over, and it spreads like leaven in a person's life. It takes over and affects you. And it leads you into bondage, because all it's going to do for you is to put you in the grave where you're going to decay. Your body's dying. It eats like a canker, says Paul to Timothy. And there is no cure, humanly speaking. There is only one cure for sin. Thanks be to God that giveth us the victory through the Lord Jesus Christ. It is a miracle, the cure for sin. For God so loved the world that he sent his only beloved Son, that whosoever believeth in him should not perish. It's a miracle. For the Lord lived and died and rose again. And so, the victory is God's. For the wages of sin are death. For all. So this man had leprosy, but he was reborn. He learnt to be humble. He then obeyed. He then went through the waters of baptism. And he rose to a new life. And you notice what he does. First of all, he tries to reward Elisha, and Elisha refuses the reward. You can't buy salvation, can you? Remember in the Acts of the Apostles, Simon thought, oh, if only I could get that gift. Here's the money, let me have the gift and I can run around doing wonderful things. You can't buy salvation. You have to learn to be humble. You have to learn to believe. You have to be born again. And so the man's money was put to one side. And then you notice what he does. Verse 17, and Naaman said, shall there not then, I pray thee, be given to thy servant 2 mules burdens of earth, for thy servant will henceforth offer neither burnt offering nor sacrifice unto other gods, but unto the Lord. He didn't give, but he received something. He received some earth. Earth that he would take back to this apostate land of Syria. Earth on which he would now worship the God of Israel. For what he has said is that now I know that there is no God in all the earth but in Israel. There is only one true and living God, and that's the God of Israel. And the God of Israel requires to be worshipped in a certain way, in a certain form. And I'm going to do that. I'm only going to worship God now, the God of Israel, in the way that he wants me to worship him. There are parallels all through Scripture, of course. You remember when Abraham came back from rescuing Lot and all the other people, and two people went out to meet him. Melchizedek and the other king. And the king wanted to reward him. And he wouldn't take anything from him. What Abraham did was actually pay tithes through Melchizedek. And here you have this lesson being learnt by this king, this king's man. You have to be humbled, you have to believe, you have to be washed clean, and now you have to worship God, the only true and living God, the way he wants you to worship. Not the way of the people round about you. Don't take their ideas. Don't take their fashions. Don't bring into your worship of the only true and living God the ideas of other people. But concentrate your mind on that which God has put before you. And so he says, in my daily life, I'm going to have to be involved with the king who goes to worship the false god. But he says, when I bow myself in the house of Rimmon, when I bow down myself in the house of Rimmon, the Lord pardon thy servant in this thing. What he's saying is, I'm not going to worship. It doesn't mean anything to me anymore. As part of my duties, I have to be present in an apostate and pagan activity. But I am going to keep my mind clean of those things. And I am not going to bow down myself in worship, because I am now going to worship the God of heaven, the God of Israel. So he departs. Once again, the chariots are girded up, and all the things are put back on the chariots, and the men all climb in, and off they go. And it says, they just went a little way. And now, the real sad element of the story comes in, with Gehazi, the servant of Elisha. Oh, he says, he's got off like that chap. He's been coming down here, raiding this country, taking away his spoil, you know, living it up. There he is, he's got all that money, wealth, he's got everything he wants. He comes down here, we get rid of his leprosy for him, and he goes off, and we don't even take a pair of shoes off him. What a carry-on. I don't see why he should go. Why should he? Why should he have all the money? Why should he have all the good time? You know, we've done a lot for him. So I'll run after him. And you notice what he says, as the Lord liveth, I will run after him. Now, just go back to verse 16. Why did Elisha refuse the gift? As the Lord liveth, before whom I stand, I will receive none of it. He was aware that he lived his life in the presence of God, and God will supply all your needs. The Shunammite woman had given him a room, a bed, a table, a candle and a chair. Anything that Elisha needed, he could have. God would give it to him, that which was necessary for his needs. Now, Gehazi says, as the Lord liveth, I will run after him. He didn't say, as the Lord liveth before whom I stand, because he'd forgotten that bit of it. And so he does. And we know the story. Naaman sees him coming, they stop the chariot, they get down. What's the problem? He says, oh well, we've changed our mind actually. We don't want anything for ourselves, but we've got these other people that have need. So if you could just spare something for us, we can give it to them. Well, it's a good enough argument, isn't it? I mean, we do that all the time, don't we? Look, if you just get me a bit more money, God, then I can help other people with it. Well, if you just give me a bigger car, I can take more people to the meeting. Well, you know, if I had a bigger house, I could put more people up. You know, I could do all sorts of wonderful things if only you give me a bit more, or whatever it is. That's the psychology of human nature. Just use what you've got, God says, doesn't he? That's what he told the widow with the oil. What have you got? Use what you've got. You'll be amazed how far it'll go. And so he says, these two men have come now from Ephraim, sons of the prophets. Give them, I pray thee, a talent of silver, 2 changes of garments. He says, whoa, no, don't tell. I'll give you more than that. You can have a lot. So he gave it to him. And he took it, and just like Achan, he rushed home with it, and he got in the back door and up to his room, and he hid it in a cupboard. My, there's his pension taken care of. He got no more worries now, has he? That's it. See, when he was going to wear it and when he was going to spend it, I don't know. It's funny, isn't it? People think like that. When was Achan going to dig up that floor of the tent and start wearing that garment that he got? Because the first thing he did when he stepped out of the tent was over and said, where'd you get that? You know? They do, don't they? People notice things like that. So he's got all these changes of clothes. That's the wardrobe full up now, and there's the drawers all full up with the money. Where's he going to go with it? And Elisha said, whence comest thou, Gehazi? And he said, I haven't been anywhere. What do you mean? Where have I been? See how one lie leads to another. Start off now, he's on that slippery path. He's now got to build up a whole wall of deceit to justify his actions. And then you see, went not mine heart with thee when the man turned again from his chariot to meet thee. You see, Elijah and Elisha are representative, aren't they, of the angelic host. They know the thoughts and intents of our hearts. They go with us. They despair as they see the things that we get into and get up to. Went not my heart with thee when the man stepped from his chariot. That was the point of no return. You see, the chariot could have gone on, or Gehazi could have stopped him. No, I won't go through with this. But once the man stepped from his chariot and shook him by the hand, the point of no return. The sin was committed. And so he says to him, is this a time? Is this a time to receive money and receive garments and olive yards and vineyards and sheep and oxen, men servants and maid servants? You have poor old Gehazi sitting there. All I've got is some clothing and shekels. What's all this about vineyards and olive yards and maid servants and all these other things? But you see, one thing leads to another. That's what covetousness is like. It doesn't, you see, it's contagious. It doesn't just stop at one change of clothing, it wants another change of clothing. It doesn't just want a little bit of money in the bank, it wants a lot of money in the bank. It grows and grows, and Elisha knows this. Once you start going down this road, it just spreads out until the world becomes your oyster of things that you want. And so he said, the leprosy therefore of Naaman shall cleave unto thee and unto thy seed forever. And he went out from his presence a leper as white as snow. It's a sad end, isn't it, brothers and sisters, to what is a powerful story. Here was a man who had everything. He had a master in Israel who was a prophet of God, who could arrange for leprosy to be wiped out, who could tell people what the purpose of God was, who could instruct them in the ways of righteousness. Here he was, living in the house with the man of God, caught up in the materialism of the age. And hundreds of miles away was a little maid who was able to say, if only you were with the prophet in Samaria, he would cure you of your leprosy. Now when you come to Luke chapter 12, the Lord Jesus Christ is very conscious of this period of Elijah and Elisha. You will recall when the Lord started his ministry in the Galilee area, that when he'd gone to Nazareth, they actually had sort of asked him to show his miracles there, and he'd reminded them that there were many lepers in Israel at the time of Elisha the prophet, and none of them was cleansed except Naaman the Syrian, and because of that they'd risen up in great wrath and anger and would have stoned him to death. You see, Jesus was aware of the fact that God looks for the heart that has been humbled, those who are prepared to believe and will ultimately obey. That's what's necessary. And the Pharisees and the scribes were not like that. They were proud, they were puffed up, they were whited sepulchres. They were the very opposite of what God needed to work with. Now when you come to Luke chapter 12, this is a chapter which tells us in verse 15 that Jesus says, "Take heed and beware of covetousness, for a man's life consisteth not in the abundance of the things which he possesseth. And he spake a parable unto them, saying, The ground of a certain rich man brought forth plentifully. And the man built bigger and better barns, and said, I will take my rest, because I've got all that I need. This night thy soul shall be required of thee." Now as you read chapter 12, brothers and sisters, I just want you to look at all the echoes. In verse 24, you have got the ravens. In verse 29, you have the double-minded. In verse 35, you have the loins to be girded. In verse 40, you have, "Be ready, for in an hour that you think not the Son of Man cometh." In verse 45, you have the drunken ruler partying away and ill-treating his servants, just like Ahab did with Naboth. And in verse 54, you've got this, "When ye see a cloud rise up out of the west, straightway ye say, There cometh a shower." Now all the way through this chapter, there are the echoes of the ministries of Elijah and Elisha. There are the incidents at Kereth, Carmel, Naboth's vineyard. All through this teaching of Jesus, there is being reflected that the covetousness and the materialism of the age will blunt us, it will blind us, it will deafen us to the fact that God looks for the man that is humbled, the man that is prepared to believe, the man that is prepared to obey, the man that desires to be born again, that his flesh may come unto him as a little child, that he may be cleansed of all his sins. And what Jesus says is, if you let this world get hold of you, you won't be able to do it. If you let the covetousness of human nature take hold of you, then you will not be able to go through this process that's necessary to be reborn. So of course, when we come to Paul's writing to the ecclesia at Ephesus, he just reminds us, doesn't he, that that's the work of the Lord Jesus Christ. That as in a relationship between a husband and a wife, there is this act of service, so he tells us there that Christ also loved the ecclesia, the church, and gave himself for it, that he might sanctify it, that he might set it apart and cleanse it with the washing of water by the word. The only way, brethren and sisters, that we are going to be able to combat, to stand against the covetousness of human nature, the materialism of the world, the only way we're going to be able to turn our back on the vineyards and the olive yards, the only way we're going to be able to decline the shekels and the changes of garments, the only way we're going to be content with what God has given us and use that in his service, is when we are prepared to be humbled, to believe, to be washed clean through the waters of baptism in the death and resurrection of the Lord, and to allow the water of the word day by day to permeate through the surface of our souls and to actually lead us in the paths that God would have us go. that we must learn to take from Scripture those two mulefuls of earth and carry them with us wherever we go, so that in whatever circumstance we find ourselves, we can actually worship the God of Israel, the God of heaven and earth, and be His servants and not the servants of sin.